The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 12, Side 1.
These MVD troops, how much did they understand of what they were doing, and what did they think of it? Maria Sumberg was deported by a Siberian soldier from the River Chulim. He was demobilized shortly after, went home, saw her there, grinned delightedly, and hailed her effusively. "Hello there, remember me?" Sometimes, however, the speed of the operation worked to the advantage of the victims. A whirlwind blew up and was gone. Even the best broom leaves specks behind. If some woman managed to hang on for 3 days, spent the nights away from home, then went to the tax office and asked them to unseal her apartment, well, sometimes they would. "All right, damn you, live there till next time." In small cattle cars, intended for the transport of 8 horses or 32 soldiers or 40 prisoners, they carried 50 or more exiled Talinas. They were in too much of a hurry to equip the cattle cars and did not give immediate permission to hack holes in the floors. The old bucket in which the exiles relieved themselves was soon brimful, running over and splashing their belongings. From the first minute, these two-legged mammals were made to forget that men and women are different. They were shut up for a day and a half without food and without water. A child died. But of course we read all this not so very long ago, didn't we? 2 chapters ago, 20 years back. But nothing has changed. They stood for a long time in the station at Ulamista, with people running up and down outside, banging on the sides of the cars, asking for friends and relatives by name, unsuccessfully trying to pass provisions and comforts to one or another of them. These people were chased away, while those locked in the boxcars went hungry, and Siberia awaited its lightly clad guests. The authorities began issuing bread on the journey, and at certain stations, soup. All the trains had a long haul before them to the provinces of Novosibirsk, Irkutsk, Krasnoyarsk. Barabinsk alone was the destination of 52 carloads of Estonians. Exiles to Achinsk were 14 days on the way. What can sustain people on such a desperate journey? The hope which is brought not by faith, but by hatred. Their end is near. There will be war this year, and we shall go home in the autumn. No one who has not experienced such misfortune, either in the Western or in the Eastern world, can be expected to understand or sympathize with, or perhaps even forgive, the mood of those behind bars at that time. I have said already that we, too, had the same beliefs, the same yearnings in those years, 1949 to 1950. These were the years in which the iniquity of the system, with its 25-year sentences and its return trips to the archipelago, reached a new explosive level, became so glaringly intolerable that its guardians could no longer defend it. Let us put it generally, if a regime is immoral, its subjects are free from all obligations to it. Only by savagely mutilating their lives could you make thousands of thousands in cells, in prison vans and prison trains, pray for a devastating atomic war as their only way out. But no one wept. No one. Hatred is dry-eyed. Another thing the Estonians thought about on the journey was the reception they could expect from the people of Siberia. In 1940, the Siberians had stripped exiled Balts bare, bullied them into handing over their belongings, paid half a bucket of potatoes for a fur coat. We were, of course, all so ill-clad in those days that the Balts really did look like bourgeois. Now, in 1949, the word was put around in Siberia that those who were being brought were incorrigible kulaks. But these kulaks were dumped out of their cattle cars in rags and near the end of their endurance. At medical examinations, Russian nurses were amazed that the women were so thin and so shabby that they hadn't a clean rag for their babes. The new arrivals were sent to Kolkhoz's Short of People, and there the peasant women of collectivized Siberia, keeping it a secret from their bosses, brought them whatever they could spare, half a litre of milk from one, a griddle cake made of sugar beet pulp or very bad flour from another. Now, at last, the Estonian women wept. But there were also, of course, the Komsomol activists. They took the arrival of this fascist rabble very much to heart. "They should drown the lot of you," such people shouted, and greatly resented their reluctance to work. Ingrates for the country which had liberated them from bourgeois slavery. These Komsomols were given the task of supervising the exiles and their work, and they were warned, at the first shot, they should organize a round-up. At Achinsk station there was an amusing mix-up. The Biryliussi district bosses bought from the convoy 10 wagon loads of exiles, 500 people or so, for their collective farms on the River Chulym, and briskly shifted them 150 kilometres to the north. They had, in fact, been assigned to the Saralinsk Mining Administration in Kakassia, but, of course, they did not know it. The mine managers were awaiting their contingent, but the contingent had been sprinkled about collective farms in which the year before peasants had received 200 grams of grain for a work day. By that spring there was neither grain nor potatoes. The villages were loud with the bellowing of hungry cattle, and the cows flung themselves like mad things on half-rotted straw. So it was not out of malice or to keep the exiles on a tight rein that the collective farms gave these newcomers 1 kilogram of flour per person per week. That was a very respectable advance, almost equivalent to their total future earnings. For the Estonians it was an appalling change from their homeland. There were, in fact, big barns full of grain in a nearby settlement called Polevoy. Stocks had mounted up from year to year because nobody had made arrangements to remove them. But this was now state grain, and the Kolkhoz had no claim to it. The people all around were dying, but no grain from those barns was given to them. It belonged to the state. On one occasion, Kolkhoz chairman Pashkov took matters into his own hands and issued 5 kilograms to each kolkhoznik still living, and was sentenced to the camps as a result. The grain belonged to the state. The Kolkhoz's troubles were its own affair, and this is not the book in which to discuss them. There, on the Chulym, the Estonians lived a life of desperation, trying to master an astounding new law, steal or die. They had begun to think that they were there forever, when suddenly they were all plucked out and driven off to the Saralinsk district of Kakassia. The owners had found their missing contingent. There were no actual Kakassians to be seen there. Every settlement was a place of exile, and in every settlement there was an MVD post. There were gold mines, new shafts being sunk, silicosis everywhere. Indeed, these broad expanses were not so much part of Kakassia or the Krasnoyarsk region as the territory of Kakzoloto, the Kakassian Gold Mining Trust, or Yeniseistroy, the Yenisei Development Authority. They belong not to the district Soviets and district party committees, but to the generals of MVD troops, and the secretaries of district party committees truckled to the local MVD commanders. But those who were simply sent to the mines did not have the worst of it. Much worse off were those who were enrolled in prospecting artels. Prospectors. It has a romantic ring. The word glistens as though lightly dusted with gold. But any idea you like to think of can be given an ugly twist in our country. Special settlers were forced into these artels because they dared not object. They were sent to work mines which the state had abandoned as unprofitable. There were no longer any safety measures in these mines, and water ran in continually as though it were raining heavily. The yield was low, however hard you worked, and it was impossible to earn a decent wage. These dying people were simply sent in to lick out the residual traces of gold which the state was too miserly to abandon. The teams came under the prospecting sector of the mining administration, which thought of nothing, recognized no obligation, except to hand down the plan and exact fulfillment. The artels were free, not from the state, but only from the benefits of its legislation. They were not entitled to paid leave, nor, as a matter of course, to Sundays off, as even Zeks in the camps were, since any month might be declared a Stakhanov month, with never a Sunday in it. The state's rights were preserved. A man who did not turn up for work was put on trial. Once every 2 months, a people's judge arrived and condemned several exiles to 25% compulsory labor. There were always plenty of excuses. These prospectors earned 3 to 4 gold rubles, 150 to 200 Stalin rubles, per month. At certain mines near Kopyov, the exiles were paid not in money, but in vouchers. What need had they, in fact, of ordinary Soviet currency when they could not move around anyway, and the shop at the mine would accept payment in coupons as well? Elsewhere in this book, we have developed in detail a comparison between prisoners in the camps and peasants in the days of serfdom. But if we remember our Russian history, we know that the hardest conditions were those not of the peasants, but of workers tied to factories. These vouchers, expendable only in the mine shops, bring memories of the gold mines and factories of the Altai flooding into our minds. The miners assigned to these enterprises in the 18th and 19th centuries deliberately committed crimes in order to get into katorga and have an easier life of it. Even at the end of the last century, workers in the Altai goldfields had no right to refuse work even on Sunday. They paid fines, compare the compulsory labor system, and there were shops with poor quality provisions, cheap drink, and short measure. These shops, and not the incompetently conducted mining operations, were the main source of income for the gold mine owners, or in modern terms, the trust. Strange that everything on the archipelago should be so unoriginal. In 1952, KHS, a frail little woman, did not go to work in a hard frost because she had no felt boots. For this, the head of the woodworking artel sent her logging for 3 months, still without felt boots. 3 months before childbirth, she asked to be given some lighter work than heaving logs, and the answer was, "If you don't want the job, give it up." Then a benighted woman doctor got the date of her confinement wrong by a month and did not send her on leave until 2 or 3 days before she had her child. Argument will get you nowhere out in the MVD's taiga. But even there, life was not wrecked beyond repair. Total ruin was an experience reserved for those special settlers who were sent to collective farms. There are people nowadays who debate, and it is not a foolish argument, whether life was really any easier in the Kolkhoz than in the camps. But what, we may answer, if Kolkhoz and camps are combined? Well, that was the position of the special settler in the Kolkhoz. It was a Kolkhoz to the extent that there were no regular rations. Only at sowing time did they issue 700 grams of grain a day, and then it was half-rotten, mixed with sand, earth-coloured, no doubt swept up from the floor of the barns. It was like a prison camp in that the settlers could be put in detention cells. If a foreman complained about one of the exiles in his gang, the Kolkhoz management would telephone the MVD post and the MVD would take the man inside. There was no way of picking up extra earnings. You couldn't possibly make ends meet. For her first year of work in the Kolkhoz, Maria Sumber got 20 grams of grain per work day. A little bird can find more hopping along the roadside. And 15 Stalin kopecks, 1.5 Khrushchev kopecks. With her earnings for a whole year, she bought herself an aluminum bowl. What, you may ask, did they live on? Why, on parcels from the Baltic states. Their people had been banished, but not the whole people. But who was there to send the Kalmyks parcels? Or the Crimean Tatars? Walk among their graves and ask them. Whether this too was part of the decision made by their own Baltic governments, or an example of Siberian correctness, special instructions concerning the Baltic exiles were observed until 1953, until the father of the peoples was no more. No work for them except the heaviest, only the pick, the shovel, and the saw. You are here to become real human beings. If a management promoted someone, the MVD post would intervene and remove him for general duties. They would not even allow special settlers to dig the gardens at the mining administration's rest home, for fear of offending the Stakhanovites who were recuperating there. The MVD post commander even had M. Sumberg dismissed from the post of calf herd. You haven't been sent here for your summer holidays. Go and stack hay. The chairman had the greatest difficulty in keeping her. She had saved his calves from brucellosis. She had become very fond of Siberian cattle, which she found better natured than Estonian beasts, and cows who were unused to kindness licked her hands. Grain suddenly had to be loaded onto barges in a hurry, and special settlers worked without pay or reward for 36 hours on end, chulim. In that whole period there were 2 breaks of 20 minutes each for food, and 1 rest period of 3 hours. Either you do it, or we'll send you farther north. If an old man fell down under the weight of a sack, the Komsomol overseers kicked him up again. Settlers had to report weekly. The MVD post is several kilometers away, you say, and the old woman is 80. Get a horse and carry her in. Every time they reported, they were reminded that attempted escape meant 20 years hard labor. The security officer's room is next door. Exiles are called in there, too. The bait of a better job is dangled, and they threaten to deport an only daughter beyond the Arctic Circle, separating her from her family. Is there anything they cannot do? At what forbidden limit was their hand ever stayed by conscience? They gave the exiles tasks to perform. Keep an eye on such and such. Gather the evidence which will imprison so and so. If the merest sergeant from the command post entered a hut, all the exiles, even aged women, had to rise and remain standing unless permission to sit was given. I hope that the reader has not misunderstood me to mean that exiles were deprived of their civil rights. Oh, no, no, their civil rights were preserved intact. Their passports were not taken from them. They were not deprived of the right to participate in elections on a universal, equal, secret, and direct ballot. That supreme, that glorious moment when you strike out all the candidates on a list except the one of your choice was jealously preserved for them. Nor were they forbidden to subscribe to the state loan. Remember what torments the communist Dyakov suffered in the camp. When free Kolkozhniki, cursing and grumbling, grudgingly gave 50 rubles, 400 each were wrung out of the Estonians. You're all rich. If anybody doesn't sign, we won't let him have his parcels, and we'll move him farther north. They would do it, too. What was to stop them? The tedium of it all. Nothing but the same thing over and over again. At the beginning of this part 6, we appeared to be discussing something new, not the camps, but the exile system. And this chapter made a fresh start. Our theme was no longer the administrative exiles, but the special settlers. Yet, we are back where we started. Must we, and if so, how often must we, repeat ourselves again and again and again? Tell the story of other and different exile colonies, in other places, at other periods, peopled by other exiled nations? And if so, which? Groups of exiles belonging to different nationalities, interspersed and clearly visible to each other, displayed their own national characteristics, their own ways of life, their own special tastes and inclinations. Far and away the most industrious were the Germans. They had hacked themselves free of their past lives more resolutely than any of the others. And what sort of homeland had they had on the Volga or the Manych? As once they had rooted themselves in Catherine's fecund allotments, so now they put down roots in the harsh and barren soil Stalin had given, abandoned themselves to this new land of exile as their final home. They began settling in, not temporarily until the next amnesty, the first act of clemency by the Tsar, but forever. They had been exiled in 1941 with not a stick or a stitch, but they were good husbandmen and indefatigable. They did not fall into despondency, and even in this place set to work as methodically and sensibly as ever. Is there any wilderness on earth which Germans could not turn into a land of plenty? Not for nothing did Russians say in the old days that a German is like a willow tree, stick it in anywhere and it will take. In the mines, in machine and tractor stations, in state farms, wherever it might be, the bosses could not find words enough to praise the Germans. They had never had better workers. By the 50s, the Germans, in comparison with other exiles and even with the locals, had the stoutest, roomiest, and neatest houses, the biggest pigs, the best milch cows. Their daughters grew up to be much sought-after brides, not only because their parents were well off, but in the depraved world around the camps, because of their purity and strict morals. The Greeks, too, ardently embraced their work. Although they never stopped dreaming about the Kuban, they grudged no effort in this new place either. Compared with the Germans, they lived in rather cramped quarters, but they soon caught up with them in the number of their cows and the richness of their gardens. In the little marketplaces of Kazakhstan, it was the Greeks who had the best cream cheese, the best butter, the best vegetables. The Koreans prospered even more in Kazakhstan, but of course they had been exiled earlier, and by the 50s were already in large measure emancipated from serfdom. They were no longer required to report, and they travelled freely from oblast to oblast, provided they did not cross the borders of the republic. They did not excel as good home builders or husbandmen. Their homes and steadings were uncomfortable and primitive until the younger people became Europeanized. But they responded very well to education, quickly filled the educational institutions of Kazakhstan, no one put obstacles in their way during the war, and became the main component of the educated stratum in the Republic. Other nations, secretly cherishing dreams of return, were incapable of such single-mindedness, of living wholly in the present. But as a rule, they submitted to discipline and gave the MVD little trouble. The Kalmyks could not stand up to it, and grieved themselves to death. Here, however, I cannot speak from observation. But there was one nation which would not give in, would not acquire the mental habits of submission, and not just individual rebels among them, but the whole nation to a man. These were the Chechens. We have already seen how they behaved toward runaways from the camps, and how they alone among the exiles of Jezkazgan tried to support the Kangia rising. I would say that of all the special settlers, the Chechens alone showed themselves Zeks in spirit. They had been treacherously snatched from their home, and from that day they believed in nothing. They built themselves Sakli, low, dark, miserable huts that looked as if you could kick them over. Their husbandry in exile was all of this sort, all just for a day, a month, a year, with nothing put by, no reserves, no thought for the future. They ate and drank, and the young people even dressed up. The years went by, and they owned just as little as they had to begin with. The Chechens never sought to please, to ingratiate themselves with the bosses. Their attitude was always haughty and indeed openly hostile. They treated the laws on universal education and the state curriculum with contempt, and to save them from corruption would not send their little girls to school, nor indeed all of their boys. They would not allow their women to work in the kolkhozes, nor did they believe in slaving the kolkhoz fields themselves. They tried whenever possible to find themselves jobs as drivers. Looking after an engine was not degrading. Their passion for rough riding found an outlet in the constant movement of a motor vehicle, and their passion for thieving in the opportunities drivers enjoy. This last passion, however, they also gratified directly. "We've been robbed. We've been cleaned out," were concepts which they introduced to peaceful, honest, sleepy Kazakhstan. They were capable of rustling cattle, robbing a house, or sometimes simply taking what they wanted by force. As far as they were concerned, the local inhabitants and those exiles who submitted so readily belonged more or less to the same breed as the bosses. They respected only rebels. And here is an extraordinary thing. Everyone was afraid of them. No one could stop them from living as they did. The regime which had ruled the land for 30 years could not force them to respect its laws. How did this come about? Here is an episode in which the explanation is perhaps epitomized. One of the pupils in the Kokhterek school when I was teaching there was the young Chechen Abdul Kudayev. He inspired no warm feelings and did not try to do so. He seemed to be afraid of demeaning himself by making himself pleasant. He was always ostentatiously cold. He was very arrogant, and he could be cruel. But you could not help admiring his clear, precise mind. In mathematics and physics he never remained on the surface with his schoolmates, but always went deeper, asked questions, tirelessly searched for the heart of the matter. Like all the children of settlers, he was inevitably drawn into the so-called social activities of the school. First the Young Pioneers Organization, then the Komsomol, the school committees, wall newspapers, character training courses, political discussion groups, the spiritual price for education which the Chechens paid so unwillingly. Abdul lived with his old mother. None of their close relations had survived except for Abdul's older brother, who had long ago taken to crime, had served more than one spell in the camps for theft and murder, but had always emerged before his time either under an amnesty or because he got remission for good conduct. One day he appeared in Kok Terek, drank for 2 days without pausing for breath, quarrelled with a local Chechen, seized a knife, and rushed at him. An old Chechen woman who had nothing to do with either of them barred his way, flinging her arms wide to stop him. If he had obeyed Chechen law, he should have thrown down his knife and given up the chase. But he was by now a thief first and a Chechen second. He brought down his knife and fatally stabbed the innocent old woman. The thought of what awaited him according to the law of the Chechens now entered his drunken head. He rushed to the MVD to make a clean breast of the murder, and they gladly put him in jail. He had found a hiding place, but that left his younger brother Abdul, his mother, and also an old Chechen of their clan, Abdul's uncle. News of the murder went around the Chechen community of Kok Terek in a flash, and all three surviving members of the Kudayev clan gathered in their house, laid in stocks of food and water, blocked the window, nailed up the door, and lay low in this fortress. The Chechens of the murdered woman's clan now had to take vengeance on some member of the Khudayev clan. Until Khudayev blood was spilled in payment for their blood, they would be unworthy to be called human beings. So the siege of the Khudayev house began. Abdul did not go to school. All Kok Terek and the whole school knew why. A member of one of the top classes in our school, a Komsomol, an outstanding pupil, was threatened with murder by the knife at any moment. Perhaps this very minute, as the bell rings and the others take their places at their desks, perhaps now, while the literature teacher is talking about socialist humanism. Everybody knew. No one forgot it for a moment. Between classes they talked about nothing else, and could not bring themselves to look at each other. Neither the party organization in the school, nor the Komsomol, nor the directors of studies, nor the headmaster, nor the district education department. Nobody went to try and save Khudayev. No one even approached his besieged home in Chechen territory, which was buzzing like a hornet's nest. And it wasn't only there. At the first breath of bloody vengeance, the district party committee, the executive committee of the district Soviet, the MVD post, and the militia behind their adobe walls, all of them so awesome to us until now, also froze in craven inactivity. A savage and ancient law had breathed on them, and all at once there was no Soviet power in Kok Terek. Nor was its heavy hand quick to reach out from the provincial capital, Jambul, for 3 days went by and no plane flew in with troops, no firm instructions arrived, except an order to defend the jail with all forces to hand. This helped the Chechens, and us too, to see clearly the difference between real power on this earth and the mirage of power. The Chechen elders were the only ones to show sense. They went first to the MVD and asked them to hand over the elder Khudayev for summary punishment. The MVD nervously refused. They came back to the MVD a second time, asking them to have Khudayev tried in public, and to shoot him while they watched. If this was done, they promised that the vendetta against the Khudayevs would be at an end. No more reasonable compromise could have been devised. But think of the difficulties. A trial in open court. An execution promised in advance and carried out in public. Khudayev, after all, was not a political. He was a thief. A class ally. the rights of 58 could be trampled underfoot, but not those of a multi-murderer. The MVD referred it to the Oblast, and the request was turned down. In that case, the old men informed them, the younger Kudaev will be killed within the hour. The bureaucrats of the MVD shrugged their shoulders. It was none of their business. They were not there to think about crimes as yet uncommitted. But some faint awareness of the 20th century touched, not the MVD, oh no, but those hardened old Chechen hearts. In spite of everything, they forbade the Avengers to exact vengeance. They sent a telegram to Alma Ata. Some other old men, those most respected by the whole people, hurried down. They convened a council of elders which anathematized the older Khudayev and sentenced him to death where and whenever he came within reach of a Chechen knife. The other Khudayevs they summoned and told, go in peace, no one will touch you. So Abdul took his books and went to school. There he was met with hypocritical smiles by the party organizer and the Komsomol organizer. From the moment of his return, he heard communist social conscience extolled in lessons and political instruction periods, with never a mention of the vexatious incident. Not a muscle twitched in Abdul's somber face. He had learned all over again that the greatest force on earth is the law of vendetta. We Europeans, at home and at school, read and pronounce only words of lofty disdain for this savage law, this cruel and senseless butchery. But the butchery is perhaps not so senseless, after all. It does not sap the mountain peoples, but strengthens them. Not so very many fall victim to the law of vendetta, but what power the dread of it has over all around. With this law in mind, no Highlander will casually insult another, as we insult each other in drink, from lack of self-control, or just for the hell of it. Still less will any non-Chechen look for trouble with a Chechen, call him a thief or a ruffian, or accuse him of jumping the queue. For the answer may be given not in words, not in abuse, but with a knife in the ribs. And even if you grab a knife yourself, but you won't have one on you, you're civilized, you cannot give blow for blow, or your whole family will fall under the knife. The Chechens walk the Kazakh land with insolence in their eyes, shouldering people aside, and the masters of the land, and non-masters alike, respectfully make way for them. The law of vendetta creates a force field of fear, and so gives strength to its small mountain people. Strike your neighbors, that strangers may fear you. The ancestors of the Highlanders in remote antiquity could have found no stronger hoop to gird their people. Has the socialist state offered them anything better? Chapter 5. End of sentence. In 8 years of prison and prison camp, I had never heard anyone who had experienced exile say a good word about it. But from his first days in jail under investigation and in transit, simply because the 6 flat stone surfaces of a cell press in on him too closely, the dream of exile burns like a secret light in the prisoner's mind, a flickering, iridescent mirage, and the wasted breasts of prisoners on their dark bunks heave in sighs of longing. If only they would sentence me to exile. I did not escape the common lot. Far from it. The dream of exile had me more powerfully than most in its grip. At the Jerusalem clay pit, I listened to the cocks crowing in the village nearby and dreamed of exile. From the roof of the checkpoint on the Kaluga Road, I looked at the unbroken mass of the alien capital and silently begged, let me get as far from it as possible to some out-of-the-way place of exile. I even sent a naive appeal to the Supreme Soviet for commutation of my 8 years in the camps to exile for life in however remote and wild a place. The elephant did not even sneeze in reply. I had not yet realized that lifelong exile would always be waiting for me, but that it would come after, not instead of, the camp. In 1952, a dozen prisoners were released from the 3,000-strong Russian camp division at Ekibastuts. It looked very strange at the time. 58 let out through the gates. Ekibastuts had been in existence for 3 years by then, and not a single man had been released, nor had anyone reached the end of his sentence. Evidently, for the few who had lived to see the day, the first wartime tenors had just ended. We impatiently awaited letters from them. A few came, directly or indirectly, and we learned that nearly all of them had been taken from the camp to places of exile, although their sentences had not included exile. But this surprised no one. It was clear to our jailers and to us that justice, length of sentence, formal documentation, had nothing to do with it. The point was that once we had been declared enemies, the state would ever after assert the right of the stronger and trample us, crush us, squash us, until the day we died. And so we were used to it. It had become so much part of us that no other state of affairs would have seemed normal either to the regime or to us. In Stalin's last years, it was not the fate of the exiles that caused alarm, but that of the nominally liberated, those who, to all appearances, were now safely beyond the gates and unguarded, those from whom the tutelary grey wing of the MVD had apparently been withdrawn. Exile, which the powers that be obtusely regarded as an additional punishment, was a prolongation of the prisoner's irresponsible existence, the fatalistic routine in which he feels so secure. Exile relieved us of the need to choose a place of residence for ourselves, and so from troublesome uncertainties and errors. No place would have been right except that to which they had sent us. This was the one and only place in the whole Soviet Union where no one could reproach us as intruders. Only there had we an assured and undeniable right to 3 square arshins of land. And if, like me, you were alone in the world when you left the camp, with no one anywhere waiting for you, exile was perhaps the only place where you could hope to meet a kindred spirit. Our masters are quick enough to arrest people, but less quick to release them. If some democratic Greek or socialist Turk had been kept in jail a single day longer than he should have been, the world press would have choked with indignation. I was happy enough to be held only a few days too long and then released? No, after that I was in transit under guard, and they kept me on the road another month in what was now my own time. Nonetheless, as we left the camp under guard, we were still careful to respect the final prison superstitions. On no account must you look back at your last prison, or else you will return. And you must do the right thing with your spoon. What was the right thing, though? Some said take it with you, or you would return for it. Others said fling it at the prison, or else the prison would pursue you. I had moulded my spoon myself in the foundry, and I took it with me. The transit prisons flashed by again, Pavlodar, Omsk, Novosibirsk. Although our sentences had expired, they had searched us, took prohibited articles from us, herded us into cramped, overcrowded cells, prison vans, Stolypin wagons, mixed us up with the criminals. The guard dogs growled at us as of old. The lads with the automatic rifles yelled, "Eyes front!" all just as before. Then, at the Omsk transit prison, a good-natured warder called out our names from our dossiers and asked the 5 of us from Ekibastutz, "Which god have you got working for you?" "Why? Where are we going?" We were all ears. Obviously it was somewhere nice. "Why, to the south," said the warder, marvelling at it. From Novosibirsk we were, in fact, diverted southward. We were going where it was warm, where there was rice, where there were grapes and apples. What could it mean? Surely somewhere in the Soviet Union Comrade Beria could find us a worse place? Could exile really be like this? I already had plans, which I kept to myself, to write a cycle of poems and call it Lines on the Beauties of Exile. At Zhambul station we were transferred from the Stolypin car with the usual harsh treatment, taken through a living corridor of escort troops to a lorry, and made to sit on the bare floor of the vehicle, as though now that we had served our time we might be tempted to run away. It was the dead of night, and only the waning moon dimly illuminated the dark avenue along which we were being carried. But there was light enough for us to see that it really was an avenue of Lombardy poplars. So this was exile. We might almost be in the Crimea. It was the end of February, and on the Irtysh, where we had come from, it was cruelly cold. But here a spring breeze caressed us. They took us to the jail, and the jail admitted us without the usual body search and bath. the accursed walls were losing some of their harshness. In the morning, the block superintendent unlocked the door and said almost in a whisper, "Come out and bring all your belongings." The devil was unclenching his claws. We stepped out into the arms of a red spring morning. The dawn light was warming the brick walls of the jail. A lorry was waiting for us in the middle of the yard, with two zecs who were joining our party already sitting in the back. This was the time to breathe deeply, to look around, to steep ourselves in the uniqueness of that moment. But we simply could not waste the chance to strike up an acquaintance. One of our new companions, a skinny, grey-haired man with pale, watery eyes, was sitting on his crumpled belongings, as upright, as majestic as a tsar about to give audience to ambassadors. You might have thought that he was deaf or a foreigner, with no hope that we should find a common language. As soon as I was up on the lorry, I decided to get into conversation with him, and he introduced himself in pure Russian, in a voice with no hint of a quaver in it, "I'm Vladimir Alexandrovich Vasilyev." And a spark of sympathy jumped between us. The heart senses who is a friend and who is no friend. This was a friend. In prison you must find out about people quickly. For all you know, you will be separated in a minute's time. No, of course we were no longer in prison, but still. Shouting above the noise of the engine, I interviewed him, and did not notice that the lorry had moved from the asphalted prison yard onto the cobbled street. Forgot that I must not look back at my last jail. How many last jails would there yet be? Did not even spare a glance for the bit of the outside world through which we were travelling. And soon we were back in the broad inner yard of a provincial MVD post, and once again we were forbidden to leave it for the town. For the first minute you might have taken Vladimir Alexandrovich for a man of 90, his eyes that looked beyond time, his gaunt features, his lock of white hair, all told the same story. He was in fact 73. He turned out to be one of the oldest surviving Russian engineers, one of our outstanding hydrotechnicians and hydrographers, in the Union of Russian Engineers. What was that? I had never heard of it before. It was a high-powered public body created by the technical intelligentsia, one of those hundred-year leaps into the future, perhaps, of which Russia made several in the first two decades of the century, but all of which miscarried. Vasilyev had been a prominent member, and he still recalled with solid satisfaction how "we refuse to pretend that dates can be grown on dry sticks," which of course was why they were disbanded. Half a century back, he had covered on foot or on horseback every inch of the Semirechye region in which we had now arrived. Long ago, before the First World War, he had drawn up plans for flooding the Chuisk Valley, for the Narin Cascade, and for boring a tunnel through the Chuili Mountains, and still, before the First World War, had begun carrying them out himself. He had sent abroad for 6 electric excavators and put them to work in this part of the world as early as 1912. All 6 survived the revolution and were passed off as a new Soviet invention at Cherkistroy in the 30s. After serving a sentence of 15 years for sabotage, the last 3 in the Verkhne-Uralsk isolator, he had obtained a special act of indulgence, permission to spend his exile and die right there in Semirechye, where he had begun his career. Even this favour would never have been granted if Beria had not remembered him from the 20s, when engineer Vasilyev had divided the waters of the Caucasus between its 3 republics. And that was why he was now sitting, sphinx-like, absorbed in his thoughts, on a sack in the back of a lorry. For him it was not just his first day of freedom, but his homecoming to the land of his youth, the land of his inspiration. No, human life is not so short as all that, if you leave memorials along the way. Not so long ago, V.A.'s daughter had stopped at a newspaper window on the Arbat in Moscow to look at Trud. A devil-may-care correspondent was lavishing well-paid words on a rousing account of his journey through the Chuisk Valley, which had been irrigated and brought to life by creative Bolsheviks, with descriptions of the Narin Cascade, the ingenious hydrotechnical installations, the happy collective farmers. And suddenly, who can have whispered in his ear, he ended with this: "But very few people know that all these transformations are the realization of the dream of the talented Russian engineer Vasilyev, who found no support in old bureaucratic Russia." At the end of 1917, Vasiliev was, for all practical purposes, the head of the Department of Land Improvement. How sad that the young enthusiast did not live to see the triumph of his noble ideas! This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.